So this afternoon I'd like to offer you the usual Dharma talk that I give on equanimity. And I might, during certain times of the talk, I might want to have some back and forth with you and know what your responses are to certain things. So I'm improvising this as we go along so that I can understand a little bit more about what you're experiencing and help you more directly, support you in your practice more directly. It's an understatement to say that we live in a time of great change. There's so much happening around us politically, in the environment, culturally, seeing how fast it goes with our own children growing up and our grandchildren, too, how fast it's all happening, how many changes take place in my own family. Just, it seemed like only yesterday, my eldest grandchild now is 18, and only yesterday I was holding her in my arms, it seems like, when she was only a few months old. Our physical environment and change in the climate is evident at so many levels, even on Maui, where we're in the middle of the Pacific Ocean, and there usually isn't much change in being in that part of the world, in the middle of such a great body of water. But we see great changes in our environment there, to either a lot of dryness or a lot of wetness, and floods and earthquakes there also. Not as bad as they are in other parts of the world, but still we see the great change that's happening in that part of our lives. And it brings us to the deeper and more in-our-face realization of how, on that level, it's change is such a fact of life that we can't really deny it. Maybe we want things to be permanent. Of course we do, especially when they're pleasant. We want the pleasantness to stay. And when they're unpleasant, of course, it's easy to say, oh, change, change, may it happen quick. You know, we want this pleasantness, unpleasantness to go away. The Buddha talked a lot in all of the suttas. In many places, he talked about the eight worldly conditions that show this change that goes on, the constantly changing conditions that we're bearing witness to in the news, praise and blame, gain and loss, fame and disrepute, pleasure and pain. It wasn't that long ago when, you know, we were all hurrahing for the new political situation that has come about with the, at least some of us, with the Obama administration. And for the same ones of us, it might be the opposite right now, you know, that, gee, what happened? I had all my hopes up, and, you know, they're sometimes down the drain, and it goes up and down every day. So praise and blame, gain and loss, pleasure and pain, fame and disrepute, we see it all over the place. How can we maintain a balance is a question that I often hear, just even in next door in the room during the Q&A period. How can we maintain a balance of staying compassionate through all of this, of staying attentive? Our minds want to go away from all of this. You know, we want to get in somebody else's movie and attend all those great movies that are coming up on the... We just had a movie festival on Maui, and boy, there were so many more people going to the movies than I ever saw before. And I thought, and I talked to my friends about how it could be, because there's just so much in the world that's happening that's disagreeable, that we want to get in somebody else's movie sometimes. We want to enjoy something a little different than our own movie. How can we stay compassionate instead of being paralyzed by all that's happening? How can we maintain a balance of staying compassionate towards ourselves, too? There's a lot of times I go through life with the difficulties and ups and downs that my own family has. It's not that bad, but still, it affects me. And stay connected to what's going on in my own heart. It's a question I ask of myself a lot. When we come to even a short time of retreating like this, we have the guidance and the support and the direction to go inside and to see what's going on within, to learn how to be with it, to navigate that inner terrain, to be with what's going on inside, hopefully in a more accepting way, to notice the change with a little more equanimity, hopefully. We need to be able to navigate this inner terrain of our hearts and minds. And it's not as easy to do that when we're having to deal with the outer world, with the survival that we need to have to keep our mortgage or rent paid and keep the kids going to school and keep everybody fed and as happy and balanced as possible. It's really essential that we take this kind of time to be quiet and to see what's going on and to touch those deep places inside of our hearts and minds that we don't have the opportunity, the support, to just touch, to acknowledge that this is what's going on, the pleasures inside of ourselves as well, the places where we're happy, where we can touch our goodness and our kindness, the places that are hurtful to us, that, as I've heard from a few of you say, that it's emotional sometimes coming to a retreat like this because we feel the sadness more, we feel maybe the anger more, we feel the hurt more of life. And it's hard to feel this, but it's essential to be able to touch that place, because just touching those places, even of the goodness, as I mentioned before, is something that we don't have time in our lives to do when we're so busy connecting with the outer world. We need to navigate the inner terrain with balance, and this is equanimity. The subjective experience of equanimity is not just a balance, but a spacious balance, a kind of balance we can feel where we're not balancing our lives or our bodies and minds on a razor's edge, whereas if we tip a little bit to the left, we'll just fall over and cut ourselves or hurt ourselves or vice versa, going to the right, tipping ourselves to the other side. But where we feel we have a really wide stance in our lives, a very spacious balance. Oftentimes, we hear this mountain meditation is like something that exemplifies this equanimity, this ability to be as steady as a mountain that has a wide base that can't tip over. And the mountain can take all kinds of things. It can take weather patterns that are wet or dry for a long, long time. Or there's a lot of wind, or there can be a lot of stillness, or there can be lightning and a lot of thunder, or there can be beautiful flowers growing on the mountain. The mountain, the stance of a mountain can be very stable, and it can take a lot and yet still be stable. This is a kind of spacious balance that we want to be able to have. There can be a lot of clarity in that spacious balance because we're not trying to get away from it. it's clear. We can see it more clearly because we're not running away from what is disagreeable or unpleasant, nor are we running towards or we're trying to grab onto what is pleasant. When there's that stillness of the mind that is neither running away from or running towards because of aversion or attachment, that stillness of the mind and heart can bring much more clarity to what's going on. And that clarity can bring the responses that we need to have towards ourselves, towards others, that are going to be beneficial. It just makes sense that it would happen that way. As I mentioned in the room next door just recently, just to say the phrase in a very compassionate way, this is how it is right now. Not in a dry way where it's, you know, we're kind of stern about it. This is how it is and deal with it. You know, sometimes we have that attitude towards ourselves or towards others around us, like, okay, let's, you know, can't you just deal with it? And it's very unbalancing. That attitude's very unbalancing. But the attitude when we have in our voice, in our heart ways of responding to it, okay, this is how it is right now, very compassionately, can relax the mind more. Where I live in Hawaii, there are a lot of cultures there, and we all seem to kind of blend in together, and one culture takes from another. And one of the things that it doesn't matter whether the person's Hawaiian or Portuguese or Puerto Rican or Chinese or Japanese or Korean or Filipino, there's a couple of words that people say that exemplify this is how it is. When we're saying something, how something has been challenging in our life to maybe one of the elders, or what we're going through that brings a lot of highs and or lows in our life, the people around us would say, that's how life is. But they would use the shortened version of saying, that's how it is. And it isn't exactly the words, but it's that great wisdom behind everything, and that, you know, how the elders just have lived through so much that when they say something really small, or not, it doesn't have to be a big explanation of anything, it's just the feeling that you get from their body mind experience, it just relaxes you. It just lets you accept, okay, that's how it is right now. This is how it is right now. There's an African-American minister that uses the phrase seeing the world with quiet eyes. And that's continued to affect me in kind of a guidance of how I might be able to look at the world, to see what's happening outside, in the world outside, and also in the inner world, seeing the world with quiet eyes. This is from the Reverend Howard Thurman, from the first, he's the Church of the First Interdenominational Intercultural Interracially Congregation of the Church for Fellowship of All Peoples. Pretty long, but in San Francisco. Anyway, he wrote this from his collection of meditations entitled Deep is the Hunger. How may one work in the world courageously and intelligently on behalf of a decent world without despair and complete fatigue? What are the resources for personal rehabilitation and renewal? That we may be able to look out on life with all its vicissitudes, its cruelty and transcendent joys, with quiet eyes and a tranquil spirit. So it's a big question. How may we look out upon the world with tranquil eyes and a spirit that's that way too? I think it's a question that we all keep trying to answer for ourselves. Sometimes the questions are more important than the answers, because the answers keep changing. How we respond to things in a better and better and better way, that keeps changing. If we keep presenting ourselves with these important questions, how can we do this? How can we more skillfully deal with the inner terrain, with the outer terrain of life? So as I engage in the various facets of my life, I ask myself, am I seeing the world with quiet eyes? Seeing the world with quiet eyes. Am I discerning whether I'm drawing from an inner reservoir of really living from a place, not just trying to make it up, but really living from a place of being able to respond to life with a lessening of reactivity? Now, reactivity is the opposite of equanimity. It's called the far enemy of equanimity. And when we're not seeing the world with quiet eyes or from that gentle spirit, it's when we're really reacting to what's going on, inwardly or outwardly. Reactivity has two parts. The first part of reactivity is attachment, and the other side of it is aversion. When things are pleasant, we react with attachment, with grasping, with wanting it to be a certain way, or continue in that way. And when things are unpleasant, we react with aversion, with displeasure, with pushing away. And you can see that there's a lot of restlessness in the mind when this is happening. And so, because of that restlessness, can't see clearly, can't access those places beyond or in the stiller parts of our hearts where we might be able to draw upon a reservoir of more wisdom, of more inner quietude. Being able to use the precepts as support is a great support for equanimity, because we can draw upon our goodness, our ability to not harm ourselves or others through attachment or through aversion, because this is what the precepts are helping us to be strong in relationship to, either attachment and or aversion. So in our training here and in the world, we're learning how to open our hearts more. But to really be able to do that through the metta practice, through the compassion practice, it's very essential to learn how to be more balanced, more equanimous, less reactive to what's going on. Because that's when we'll be able to be more skillful in our lives. In the Dhammapada, it's a collection of verses by the Buddha, there's a metaphor of a rock that is used in terms of equanimity. A rock and its steadiness. Steadiness is a function of this strong balance of mind. When we look up what's the function, what's the manifestation, what's a characteristic of these qualities of mind, it's said that steadiness is the function of equanimity. When we can feel, we really feel that our response to life, which may be actually in that moment, a wise response may be not to respond for the time being, but to be more still for a moment or a day or a week before we take action. But we feel that it's coming from a great steadiness, that we can be able to have a response from a deeper place, from a place of more wisdom. And we feel that from steadiness. It's one of the first things we might feel in the experience of equanimity. We feel steady inside. It said, as a solid mass of rock is not stirred by the wind, so a sage is not moved by praise or blame, gain or loss, joy or sorrow. So this steadiness that isn't moving about allows us to still the mind, to see more clearly what's going on underneath. I saw this kind of steadiness which brought about a lot of balance and patience in a friend of mine. She said that when she went through these trying times, which she gave me the permission to tell the story about, what helped her a lot through trying times is saying the phrase to herself, "May I accept things as they are." Another way of saying, "This is how it is." It's just opening to the possibility and recognizing that it isn't happening right now, but may I accept things as they are. A few years ago, one of her grown sons had disappeared. He was in his early 20s, and she lived on Maui. She doesn't now, but at that time she did. And she didn't know what happened to him and didn't know if he was involved in some drugs in one way or another in the danger because of being caught in some wrong understanding with it. But he disappeared and was not making contact with any of his family or friends that would say anything to his family. But she held an inner vigil of patience and steadiness. And she was just able to be with that temporary loss because she didn't know exactly what happened. And she was able to just be with the mystery of it and just keep her heart open, all the while watching for that attachment that would come up. This way, the movement of the heart to just be so strongly grabbing with the hope of that he's alive, he's around somewhere. But also with understanding maybe he's not, and can my heart face that too? It was pretty hard for all of us women around her to also to be with that. Eventually, she and her partner decided to sell their property on Maui and travel around the world. One of their daughters was giving birth in, I forget whether it was Portugal or Spain, and that was part of their round-the-world trip. And they had spent so long in such sorrow that they thought this would be good for them. They made all the plans, and just before they left, their son reappeared and made contact with them. They were very, very happy about this. And so they went on their trip, and they were with the birth of their new granddaughter, being with their daughter in that European country. And before that, actually, while they were going to Asia, her partner came down with a medical diagnosis that was not good. He had to have surgery immediately. There was a lot of fear, a lot of scariness, and it was something with regards to, something cancerous. He turned out okay, but they went through a lot of ups and downs in Asia. And all during this time, her kind of mantra that inclined the mind towards equanimity was, "May I accept things as they are," so that she could take skillful action whenever she needed to. She also went through her health challenges. She almost lost her eyesight, and this is when they were traveling in Asia. And so it was a lot of ups and downs for them. She had a lot of practice with equanimity. Then they were with the birth of their beautiful grandchild. And while there, she got the news that her other son, not the son that just showed up, but another son, a younger, with whom she had an active Buddhist practice with, had drowned. So there was just in this very short time a lot of birth and joy and death and despair. And it was incredibly, incredibly heavy for her. And we were coming to a retreat, actually, at Cloud Mountain Retreat Center. And she asked if we could get together with her, and she just happened to be in Portland during that time, just before the funeral. And so we met with her and her husband. And she said that the thing that helped her through it all, more than anything else, and I know everybody's unique, but for her, what helped her was equanimity. To be able to be with those incredible ups and downs of her life, and to stay steady with it, to not lose faith in life, and to be able to see the strength that came in her own mind and heart about it. And this is quoting her. I asked if I could quote her. She said, "I feel most genuine when I can hold in the sorrow of losing, hold in my heart the sorrow of losing Alex along with the love and joy of who he was." So even in that, you know, she was holding the sorrow and the love and joy of who he was and is in the same place, in the same spacious balance. "I'm staying connected," she says. "It seems to me this kind of loss can either destroy us or make us stronger. And I'm determined to learn and grow from it. The Dharma has been very helpful." This happened just a few years ago. It said that the proximate cause for equanimity to arise is understanding. I'm going to put it in a bigger sense. An understanding that situations come together that are out of our control, that come from untraceable intentions and actions in the past, that come from causes and conditions sometimes that are unknowable, that are mysterious to us. And it's really helpful in the practice of equanimity to know that it really arises from that deep wisdom, from that understanding that largely things are out of our control. Yes, they're in our influence, but especially with what is happening in this moment or has already happened, it's out of our control because it's doing its thing already, or it has done its thing. Its process has been completed already. What we do have control over is how we respond to it. And this is mainly what our practice is all about. How are we responding to life? Are we responding with one of the opposites of equanimity, that part of attachment to how we think it should be, or aversion to how it is? This is all part of reactivity. Or can we just say, "I can truthfully say that this is unpleasant, but this end, I can also truthfully say this is how it is." Not to deny the unpleasantness of the situation, or even not to deny the wrongness of a situation, but to accept that it is the way it is. And oftentimes we're so caught up in the story about the wrongness of it, or the hurtfulness of it, that it's hard for us to see or to open to accepting, okay, it's how it is. And sometimes it takes time for us to, we need to give ourselves time to go through all of that, to go through the struggle a little bit before we can accept how it is. So steadiness, this is one of the qualities. Spaciousness, another quality that my friend Karen said about keeping the heart big enough to be able to hold the sorrow and the joy of her son at the same time. So spaciousness, that infinite spaciousness that we can feel, that this is all part of life. Birth and death, it's all part of life. What are we denying when we can't accept that? We're denying the truth of life. I mean, it's so easy for me to say because I'm giving the Dharma talk, but when I'm in these situations, it's not that easy. It's really not that easy for me to... I have to work on it also. I have to do the practice of intentionally opening my heart, spacious, gentle, balanced, or things that I say to myself when I need some more equanimity to help me along the way. One of the quotes somewhere, came out of somewhere, is, equanimity is love that can encompass everything yet possess nothing. It's probably from the Buddha. Equanimity is love that can encompass everything yet possess nothing. And when you look at my friend's heart, that's how it was for her. She didn't have to, she could hold it all, the life of her son, the birth of her new granddaughter, and yet the death of her son as well. It's part of life. We hold it with love, that our love can be so big. This is what makes metta really powerful, this equanimity, that our love can be so big, can be so spacious, that it can include everything. It can include what's difficult in a person. It's maybe we're not, you know, we don't have to be cozy with those people who are difficult, but we can open to the fact that they're difficult, and this is part of your life. Maybe it's more compassion that we have for them than metta. But we can have that kind of connection with, yes, you want to be happy too. Love is the basis of equanimity, but equanimity is what makes love powerful. One story again, a different story about Munindraji, one of my teachers, my first teacher. And this is a story of how his love could come out of anything, even out of what could be a fearful situation for some people. We lived at some time of my 35 years living in Hawaii. I lived in this little town called Hali'i Maili. Somebody else here lived there too. And we lived in this home that we had to renovate greatly because nobody wanted to buy it. When we finally moved into it, we found out that nobody wanted to buy it because everybody thought it was haunted. It was left alone for such a long period of time. And there was a time when Munindra came to stay with us. He was had to go through some surgery and he was recovering. So during the time that he was staying with us, I would have to leave him alone at home because I would go to work. I would try to fix something for him in the morning and either prepare ahead of time his lunch or come home for lunch and get him some lunch going. But this day, I couldn't make it home. So I called and, you know, he knew I would call once in a while to be in touch with him. So I called one time and I said, Manindraji, are you okay? And he said, Mom, he used to call me Mom. He said, because my kids called me Mom and he wanted to be one of my kids. So he said, Mom, there's been some difficulty here in the house, in his beautiful Indian accent. And he said, somebody has come into the house. It seems some young man has come into the house. And immediately I thought about this young man who was going into the homes of the neighborhood, and he would go in and go in their medicine cabinets, because in Hawaii oftentimes we just leave the doors open. And this man would just come in the neighborhood homes and get drugs out of the medicine cabinet, and he knew which ones he wanted to take. So he would just take them. So right away I knew it was this guy. So I said, well, are you okay? What's happened? He was perfectly harmless most of the time, except, you know, he liked to kind of flash sometimes. So, is that what you call it? Okay. So anyway, I said, well, hold on. I said, I think this time I'm going to call the police, because we would call the police every once in a while on Lopez, but we would call him Lopes. And so I called the police and I said, go to this house and you can interview the man that's there. He said somebody came in. So I got home and the police were there, and oh, they were really surprised, because if you ask Manindraji a question, he would give every detail possible to you. He's that kind of Buddhist, you know, detail-oriented. Talk about, if you ask him what's going on in your mind, you've got to wait a long time before he's done. So the policemen were asking him all these questions, so I was finding out about what happened. He said, this young man came into the house, and he was in his bedroom. Manindraji was in his bedroom, which is at the back of the hall. Now, I want to describe Manindraji. He's this beautiful little Indian man who wears white clothing, and he has this really shiny, dark skin. So this young man comes into the house. Manindraji is describing that he hears some noise. He goes out, and he sees this man coming up the hallway, and this man, a young man, sees this guy, older guy, shiny white robes, and probably thinks it's a ghost, and starts screaming, and he runs out the door. And he said, Manindraji said, at that point I ran after him. And so it was like, it's really a ghost. And then, well, what happened? Well, he went to the backyard, he picked up, he seemed to have a bicycle, he picked it up, and he went really fast. Well, that was the end of Lopes coming to our house. I was really happy about that. But Manindraji said he ran after the guy, and with all the gentleness and kindness in his heart, and he said, you need help. Can I help you? Can I help you? You know, because he saw that, you know, he was scared. Or, you know, why was he running away? He really looked frightened, Manindraji said. The quality of kindness and loving kindness in Manindraji's heart is, sometimes I've found it pretty unbelievable, the times I've spent with him in India, just to see how much care he could have for all beings. He didn't sense fear, but I bet if he needed to sense fear and help himself, he would. But he didn't sense fear. He just sensed that this person needed some help. Can we be that way sometimes? Can we see, you know, in somebody's eyes or in somebody's demeanor, some suffering that's going on, or some way that we can not react to them, that we can, with kind of an unwholesome state of mind, but respond with a wholesome state of mind? This is what we're able to see when we have a little more equanimity, when there's the resting of the mind before it falls into extremes. This is one of the descriptions of equanimity, resting the mind before it falls into extremes. So spaciousness, balance, clarity, stability, wisdom that comes from all of that. We're not denying anything that's going on. With equanimity, there's a full recognition of whatever's happening in our hearts. It's not trying to overlay some kind of honey on top of it. It's not trying to push it away. It's really seeing it clearly, recognizing it clearly, but not having a reaction to it. That's what equanimity is, and it's what makes all of the Brahmaviharas powerful. It makes metta more powerful because it leads the way for metta to be given even in hard times. It also makes metta more powerful because it dissolves the boundary between, say, a person we really love and a person that's difficult for us. There's no, with equanimity there's no difference. The kind of love that we can offer to a person that's close to us can have the same experiential subjective feeling as the love that we offer to somebody that's difficult for us. When we do metta and you do it over and over again and you go through the individuals, you'll begin to see, when you look at your own hearts, the quality of loving kindness that goes towards a loved one. And then you go give that quality of love to a difficult person. When you look in your heart, it's the same quality. You're not holding anything back. It's not really weakened or changed in any way. It's the same quality of love. So this is what's said about, one of the things that's said about the power of equanimity, that it makes metta so powerful because it dissolves those boundaries between those individuals with groups like that. There's an inner disarmament that happens. It disarms the reactivity. His Holiness says the best disarmament is the inner disarmament. So a little bit about the near enemy. The near enemy, it's said like that because it can seem like equanimity. That would be indifference and apathy. It can seem like equanimity because indifference and apathy is like there's a distance between one, or there's a not a connection between one and another. There's a disconnection. And so we don't feel reactivity, but we don't feel anything at all. So this is something to look out for when we do our practices also. We might feel that, I feel really cool about it, I feel really balanced. But really there's a coldness inside. It's not cool, but more like cold. It's like I don't care. But in equanimity there's a caring. There's just an absence of reactivity in that caring. So there's an honesty with equanimity without that, you know, trying to push away or trying to hold on. There's a seeing clearly what's going on. I have my own experience of equanimity. Of course, all of us do at different times. But this was one of the last times I was with Manindraji. And I really felt the spaciousness and that ability that my friend Karen talked about, to be able to hold opposite things in the same space of the heart. It was when I was, it was the last day that I was leaving India, and I was in the city of Benares, and I was with Manindraji, and we were going down the Ganges River. This is in Varanasi, more specifically. And after that river cruise, we were going to take a plane and go to from that place to Calcutta, and then I was going to take off to come home. And I didn't know if this would be the last time I would see Manindraji. It didn't turn out to be, actually, but I thought it might be. Manindraji always wanted me to go down the Ganges River, and he wanted me for a long time to take one of these boats. How many of you have been down the Ganges off of Varanasi? So you know how it is there. There are these burning ghats along the way, and where they burn the bodies of the people who have died, of course, and you can see them. It's pretty up close, depending on how where your boat is going down the Ganges. Manindra wanted me to do this because, as the perfect Dharma teacher that he was, he wanted me to experience death that close, and the burning of bodies, and sometimes the floating of the bodies and body parts in the river. He was looking in the river all the time to see if he could find a body part that he could point out to me. You know? but none showed up. Anyway, we were going down the river, and on the right side of me was these burning ghats, and quite close you could see people, loved ones that were crying and carrying on, wailing sometimes, sadness, a lot of sadness around the death. You could see the body burning sometimes, that close. It's happening in many places, all right around the steps of Varanasi where you take the boat. On the left side, the sun was coming up over the Ganges and over the land there. And it was huge. You know, the sun was so huge because close to the equator also, and beautiful, this kind of yellow, orange, red ball. It was extremely beautiful. I'd never had that kind of a sight before. So looking to my left, there was this incredible beauty of new life, the life of this new day dawning. And then to my right, there was death and sadness on one side, joy on the other, birth on one side, death on the other. And with Manindra beside me, he's taught me a lot in my practice and in my being in the Dharma. I felt very strong and very grateful, of course. So with him beside me, I really felt that ability to hold both. This is how it is, birth and death. It's how it is. And then, of course, really nearby, he's sitting really nearby, and he was very loving, you know, the kind of affectionate loving that would hold your hand and give me a hug. And he didn't want to be a monk because he couldn't do those things, you know, so he was holding my hand. And I was so grateful, and I am so grateful for having met such a person in my life who's given me, you know, even so much more than so many people have in connection to my life has. So much gratitude, and being together with him was such a joy. And then at the same time, I may not see him anymore. You know, that kind of sadness, that the impending loss of this great person in my life. So that kind of joy on one side, good fortune, and then the other side is the impending loss. And I wouldn't see him in a few hours even towards the end of the day. So having that, you know, outer condition and then seeing the inner condition, okay, can I hold this too? Can both of these be held in my heart? The joy and the gratitude of having such a person, and then the impending loss, and I was already feeling the sadness of our parting. to be able to hold all of that in one heart, and if we can ever feel that, maybe you have already, it feels like you really have a strong heart to be able to hold both, to have the gratitude of something that's been beautiful, and to let it go. And of course, it's always there in your heart, but to let go of that, the experience that you have had. And that's part of life too. It gives you that kind of steadiness that I feel that I've never had before, the ability to hold both. So I wanted to really impart to you, it's not just about balance in terms of equanimity. It's not just in terms of non-reactivity with regard to equanimity. It's also in terms of having your heart big enough that can hold both the sorrow and the joy of life, and not need to identify with either one, but to understand both are part of life. Both are part of life. You don't deny one. You don't need to grab onto the other.